Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Thanking you for joining me once again. What happens when the divine emperor says he's not divine? Japan went through that experience at the close of World War II when Emperor Hirohito, who had been previously regarded as a living god, admitted he was simply a man. And since the close of World War II, Japan has recognized its emperor as a symbol of the Japanese people, but not divine. Well, Hirohito's son, Akihito, who took the crown in 1989, abdicated the throne at the close of April. And now his son, Naruhito, is taking over as emperor. I wanted to talk with somebody about what happens in a society that thinks that their king, their emperor, their political leader is divine, and then all of a sudden have him renounce it. Dr. Helen Hardacre, who studies and teaches Japanese religions at Harvard University, will be joining me to talk about that problem. And we're also going to talk with Joseph Pierce about Tolkien and the movie. There's a biopic of Tolkien released today. Reviews are just coming out on it. And it looks as though the movie fails to explore, in any deep way, Tolkien's Catholic faith. We're going to talk with Joseph about that and also let him tell us exactly how Tolkien's faith operated, not only in his personal life, of course, and his relationships, but how it influenced his imaginary world, Middle Earth. So stay with me. We've got a lot coming up. But first, we're going to get to today's headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, May 10th. It's the Feast of St. Damian of Molokai. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. North Korean state news says Kim Jong-un ordered his military to boost its strike capability in the latest missile firing. NBC News' Janice Mackey-Frayer has the latest from Seoul.
Kim has been pushing the limits of United Nations resolutions against North Korea with tests that appear to show new and more advanced short-range missile capabilities.
Kim reportedly called for full combat posture after the U.S. said it seized a large North Korean cargo ship from carrying an illegal shipment of coal. The test of two short-range missiles on Thursday and the firing of a series of projectiles on Saturday were the first missile launches by North Korea since November of 2017. The latest tests were quickly followed by the U.S. test launches of ballistic missiles over the Pacific and off Florida. Hollywood production companies say they are going to stop filming in Georgia over a restrictive abortion law that was passed. Earlier this week, Republican Governor Brian Kemp signing a law that bans abortion once a fetal heartbeat is detected, which can be as early as 6 weeks. At least three companies have vowed to cease shooting in the state that has quietly become a major production location, largely because of tax incentives. Former Vice President Joe Biden says the U.S. should provide health care to illegal immigrants. Speaking in Los Angeles this week, the Democratic presidential candidate said, quote, anyone who is in a situation where they are in need of health care, regardless of whether they are documented or undocumented, we have an obligation to see that they are cared for. A proposed rule change could soon allow debt collectors to send unlimited text, emails, and private messages to anyone who falls behind on payments. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is proposing the change. Consumers will be able to weigh in on the proposal during a 90-day public comment period. I'm C. Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
I'm Al Cresta. At the close of April, the Japanese Emperor Akihito abdicated the chrysanthemum throne, where he had sat since 1989, and the following day, his eldest son, Naruhito, succeeded him as emperor. Akihito's reign began upon the death of his father, Hirohito, at the close of 1988, and he had led Japan through decades of domestic and international turmoil, including World War II. Most of us are probably utterly unfamiliar with the role of the Japanese emperor. Many of us, when we think about Hirohito, who was supposed to be also a god, are surprised that in the modern age, a nation like Japan would have a god on the throne. were surprised at the changes in Japan since the Second World War and the adoption of a new constitution. And now we wonder, what is the stature of the Japanese emperor today? With me to discuss this is Dr. Helen Hardacre, professor of Japanese religion and society at Harvard University. Her publications include Shinto, a history. Dr. Hardacre, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. I'm delighted to be with you today.
Well, let's begin back with Hirohito, if you don't mind. I think most of us are probably very unfamiliar with what happened to the Japanese understanding of the emperor at the close of the Second World War. The way the story is told is that the Japanese regarded Hirohito as a god, and that under the constitution forged by MacArthur, he had to renounce his divinity. Could you explain that whole sequence of events for us so we have a grasp of how they really understood Hirohito?
Yes, certainly. As your remarks suggest, it's by no means a simple or uncomplicated matter to explain. But one thing I can add to what you said is that in the years leading up to World War II and Japan's surrender, the Japanese people were indoctrinated mm-hmm. to think of the emperor as a god. As prior to the modern period, probably most people outside of the capital, which at the time was Kyoto, would not have been even very aware of the emperor or have thought of him as related to their lives. But over the course of Japan's modernization from the late 19th century up through 1945, Japan became a much more highly unified country and had for the first time its own army, an empire, which included a large portion of East Asia and also some territories in Southeast Asia, and a modern educational system in which for the first time people all over the country were being taught a very similar curriculum. And in the history and other textbooks of the time, and in other, say, school ceremonial assemblies and so on, there was a lot of reference to the idea of the emperor as a god. And so for a relatively short period of time in Japan's overall history, that is going from prehistory up to the present day, there was a period of maybe 70 years when this idea of the emperor as a god was promoted by the central government and taught in the public schools. So I think that gives us some sense of the rather shallow mm-hmm. roots of that concept. So that also helps us make sense of the fact that on January the 1st, 1946, following the end of the war, the emperor made a public declaration of his humanity, which is to say, renouncing the idea that he is a god. Now, this happened before the drafting of the Constitution post-war Japan.
So what does the post-war Constitution say about the legal status of the emperor?
That is set out in Article 1 of the post-war Constitution, which went into effect in 1947, and it states that the emperor shall be the symbol of the state and of the unity of the Japanese people. So in post-war Japan, he occupies a position somewhat similar to the monarchy in Britain mm-hmm. or other constitutional democracies that we find in Western Europe. he no longer has any religious status under the law. And while he continues to perform religious rituals that are traditional within his family, the Japanese people are under no obligation any longer to take any notice of them or to affirm them or otherwise be connected with them.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Now, with this abdication, is that unusual?
Actually, if we look at the entire history of emperors in Japan, this most recent and the current emperor, Naruhito, is number 126. And of the previous emperors going all the way back to the beginning of history, something close to 40% of them have abdicated.
Okay.
Now, I should also say that in the overall list of emperors going back to prehistoric times, the documentation on the first 15 or so of them is unclear,
okay.
And they are usually referred to as mythical emperors.
Mm-hmm.
So those include persons who are said to have lived to the age of 140 and other kinds of mythical traditions associated with them. But if you subtract them from the list of the total of 126, then something close to half of all emperors in the past have abdicated.
Okay. When did that change?
In the late 19th century, the idea of imperial divinity was taught through the public schools, but the laws at that time set out that emperors would serve for life, and there was no tradition of abdication going from roughly the 1880s to the present. So that is a period of what now, about 150 years?
Mm-hmm.
Under that slice of law, during that slice of Japanese history, there has been a law in effect that prohibits abdication. But as I mentioned, if you look over the whole span of Japanese history, abdication has been as common as an emperor serving until the end of his life.
Okay. How is the abdication being received?
The abdication is unusual in modern times, but I think what its effect is right now in this moment of transition to a new emperor in Japan is that because the transition is occurring after an abdication rather than a death, it's an extremely happy time in Japan.
Hmm.
And if you were to turn on Japanese TV, the whole country is in a celebrating mood. People are talking about the first babies to be born in this new era, or who hit the first home run.
Yes, okay.
In the new
era. So this is a new chapter. This becomes a new chapter, huh,
yeah.
In Japanese history?
That's right, yes, and people seem just delighted so far. Of course, it's early days, but the country is really in a celebratory mood, and it's wonderful to see the country so happy.
In the press, it was Emperor Emeritus now, Akihito, is described as much loved. Is that in contrast to his father, Hirohito?
Well, I think there is a sharp contrast. His father, Hirohito, had never publicly spoken to the Japanese people before the announcement of the surrender on August the 15th, 1945. And as we were discussing, he had been treated as something more than human.
Right.
So while his activities were described in the press, and photographs of him were available, and the people were very much aware of him up to 1945. They had not heard his voice. So there was a very abrupt turnaround after the surrender, and for the first time he went around the country meeting the people, encouraging them to rebuild Japan and to pull together in the effort to help Japan recover from the devastation of the war.
Mm-hmm.
So he was known in that kind of context. But Akihito was different yet again, because he was the first emperor to have taken office under the symbol emperor concept. So he didn't spend, as Hirohito did, the better part of his life being projected as a god,
mm-hmm.
but always as a human being. And he did a number of things to show his solidarity with the Japanese people.
Dr. Hardacre, hold it there. We'll continue conversation. I'm talking with Dr. Helen Hardacre of Harvard University, looking at the big change going on in Japan as the Emperor Akihito has abdicated and his son Naruhito is being brought about as the new emperor. The occasion for the reason for our conversation is, during World War II, the Japanese regarded their emperor as a god, and he had to renounce his divinity at the close of the war. And I'm trying to get a feel for how that has affected the Japanese people. It's to me, it's a fascinating development. I'm Al Cresta. More coming.
Are you tired of investing in the culture of death? Would you like an advisor who understands retirement issues while respecting your Catholic beliefs? Would you like a portion of your life insurance to go to a Catholic cause or church of your choice? Contact Joseph Vitale at American Retirement Solutions, 855-756-5700. Helping you preserve your retirement while preserving your beliefs and values. Call Joe at 855-756-5700.
Every Sunday at the end of Mass, we are encouraged to go and announce the gospel of the Lord. But in this day and age, doing this can be challenging. Amidst so much bad news, so much division, we may be discouraged, we may be afraid, we may not know how to go forward. That's why UnleashTheGospel.org delivers inspirational videos and stories that will renew your missionary spirit and help you know where to start. Let's become joyful missionary disciples together. Visit UnleashTheGospel.org to join the mission. UnleashTheGospel.org. Stories to inspire you. Resources to encounter, grow, and witness.
Hi, I'm Dan Weingartz. Join us for our Time to Mow sale going on now through May 18th. Our family has been helping families like yours choose the right power equipment for your lawn since 1945. Our experts will help you choose the right product from top brands like Steel. From legendary chainsaws, dependable trimmers, and powerful blowers, a Steel is designed for reliability and built for the long haul. Visit us to see the full Steel line or see all of our Time to Mow sale specials at Weingartz.com.
Weingartz, everything from lawn to snow.
This Mother's Day, bless the Catholic mothers in developing countries who spend hours collecting drinking water, often from unsafe sources. With your support, Cross Catholic Outreach can provide these women and their children with access to clean, safe water. Help us lift the poor's burdens, protect their health, and restore their hope. Join by calling Cross Catholic Outreach at 888-766-2426. Or visit crosscatholic.org/Ave Maria.
Abortion.
Pornography.
Embryonic stem cell research.
Corporate contributions to Planned Parenthood. Do you invest in companies that are engaged in these practices? The Ave Maria Mutual Funds don't, and their investment portfolios reflect that. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can consider investing in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. The advisor invests in securities only if they meet the fund's investment and religious requirements, and as such, the return may be lower or higher than if the advisor made decisions based solely on investment considerations. The fund's method of security selection may or may not be successful, and the fund may underperform or outperform the stock market as a whole. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. For a prospectus, which includes objectives, risk, fees, charges, expenses, and other information that should be read and considered carefully before investing, call 1-866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. Distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Each week we go into the Ave Maria CD library. We pull on a talk or two to see what our Lord might have to say to us. Most of these talks are recorded at area gatherings and conferences. Most of the speakers are nationally known. The topics are varied, but they are all centered on the Lord, and they all are worth your listening time. You're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Why not sit back and join us? Be fed on the Lord. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting On the Mind of Christ on 990 WDEO in the Metro Detroit area and 1440 WMAX in the Saginaw Valley. Putting On the Mind of Christ is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. I'm talking with Dr. Helen Hardacre, who is a specialist in the area of Japanese religions at Harvard University. And we're looking at what's been going on in Japan. The Emperor Akihito has abdicated. His son Naruhito is now in the process of being brought into the full emperor role. What makes this fascinating is that Akihito is the son of Hirohito, who was the notorious emperor during the Second World War. And at that time, the Japanese emperor was also considered a living god. Now, Hirohito was had to renounce that at the end of the Second World War. And his son, Akihito, who's just abdicated the throne, Akihito gave the Japanese emperor a much more common touch, greater interest in the Japanese people themselves. And Dr. Hardacre, exactly how did he do that?
First, in the choice of his wife, instead of marrying within the old aristocracy, he married a woman of outside of that small category. We wouldn't call her ordinary, because she was born into a very wealthy and cultured family and had a very cultured upbringing that was exceptional in the times. But she was nevertheless of the common people, is the way she's looked at, mm-hmm. I think. And rather than sending her children to be raised by a wet nurse and a series of nannies or governesses, she and the emperor raised them in a family atmosphere so that the Japanese people, looking at them, thought, oh, they are like us.
Yes, okay.
Now, obviously, they live at a standard of living that is by no means average, but the comparison with the previous emperor was really striking.
Hmm.
And if I can come a little bit closer to the present, they made a point of when there would be some natural disaster, like a terrible earthquake, two of which occurred during that reign in 1995 in the city of Kobe, and then in 2011, a terrible earthquake followed by a tidal wave, and then the meltdown of a nuclear plant up mm-hmm. in the northeast region of the country just devastated a huge swath of the countryside. And rather than cowering in the palace, they went up there and visited people in the shelters, heard their stories, held their hand, did whatever they could to comfort the people in this time of terrible suffering, and they are very fondly remembered for that kind of thing.
Well, how they looked upon and commemorated World War II and mediated that experience to the people.
They went a number of times on overseas trips to the former colonies or areas where terrible battles of World War II had occurred.
Like Okinawa?
And yes, uh-huh. But also outside of Japan as
okay.
well. And they're offered prayers for the dead, and not only the Japanese military, but all the people who had suffered as a result of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And this also is very fondly remembered by many in Japan today as part of what Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko did to show their solidarity with the Japanese people and their upholding of a very humane and humanitarian ideal for the people as a whole. So these are some of the ways that Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko have shaped the concept of the symbol emperor.
Mm-hmm. I read in one piece that he was a very conciliatory figure and expressed deep remorse about Japan's role in the Second World War, and that the present prime minister found that to be a little bit over the top. Was there conflict between the present prime minister and Akihito when it came to remembering the war?
Well, nothing that ever really came to the surface in terms of the prime minister having made any overt criticism
okay.
of the emperor on this subject. But constitutional scholars on both the left and the right have said, and this is not my field, so I can't, I'm not in a position to either endorse the view or to criticize it,
sure.
but just to let you know that it's out there, is given that the Constitution states that the emperor will be a symbol of the people, if we go on and look at the fine print of that article, it also says that he should not exercise any political influence.
Mm, okay.
So constitutional scholars have said, well, what about these trips? Is he intervening in politics here?
Mm-hmm,
is he seeking to sway the views of the Japanese people? And if so, is that outside the bounds of what we want a symbol of the unity of the people to be doing? And so I think that is a question that has been raised both on the left and the right, but we certainly do not find the people as a whole standing up and saying, oh, no, we don't want him doing that, or
okay.
yes, we think that's great. You know, it's not something that has occasioned a large-scale public reaction, though from what we know from public polling, in general, the reaction has been more positive than negative.
Okay. One last question for you. With the new emperor, people are
yes.
celebrating, this is a new era. What are they anticipating regarding his future? How he will be the symbol? How will he embody this, be the symbol of the people, differently than his father?
Well, yes. Well, as you know, he assumed office 1 week ago today, so we don't yet have a whole lot of concrete evidence to base a response on, but in everything he has said so far, it seems that his intention is to continue his father's efforts to structure the symbol emperor concept, mm-hmm. and he has expressed his wish that Japan shall continue to live in peace and that the people shall continue to enjoy a standard of living that they have now, a level of culture that the country has built over its very long history, and to continue its traditions. Now, of course, tradition is a word that different people might define in different ways,
mm-hmm.
but so far it seems that he's referring in the first instance to the precedent established by his father.
So then where are they in the process of installing him as emperor at this moment?
What has happened so far is that the imperial regalia have been transmitted to him, and he is now formally the emperor of Japan. But in October, there will be an enthronement ceremony which is much more public and to which foreign dignitaries by the hundreds will be invited.
Mm-hmm.
And that will display the emperor and the new empress ascending thrones, and the emperor will proclaim his enthronement in a much more public way,
okay.
that is, addressing the world as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
That will happen in October, and then about a month later, in mid-November, a ceremony from the tradition of the imperial house will be held, in which he symbolically shares a meal with his imperial ancestors, going back, as they think of it, to the age of the gods.
Mm, okay.
And that, plus a visit to the Issei shrines, where those ancestors are enshrined as deities, will complete the whole series of enthronement ritual. So what has occurred on May the 1st is stage one,
okay.
you might say, which will be followed by stage two, the public ceremony announcing the enthronement to the world at large in October, and then this final stage that occurs in mid-November. So those future stages of the ceremonies will be covered in the press, I believe, and I would just urge your viewers to be aware of them also, and to see the display that they will make of Japanese tradition in various ways.
Very good. Well, Dr. Hardacre, thank you for taking the time to be with me today. It's very, very helpful, and I hope we can talk again in the future.
I look forward to that. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much.
Dr. Helen Hardacre is professor of Japanese religion and society at Harvard University. And this idea of the divine king is fascinating. Of course, the early church had to contend with this because at the time that Christ was on the earth, the Roman emperor was considered divine. And the phrase was, Caesar is Lord. The early Christians had trouble not because they were, quote, religious. They had trouble because they were politically radical. They said, Jesus is Lord. And by saying Jesus is Lord, they posed a direct threat to the Roman Empire. Jesus is Lord cannot stand in the same company as Caesar is Lord. And that's really why the early Christians were persecuted, not for merely religious reasons, but because they did represent a threat to the harmony of the Roman Empire.
Guesthouse is hosting their 34th annual Golf Classic on Monday, June 24th at Oakhurst Golf and Country Club in Clarkston. Enjoy 18 holes of golf, followed by dinner, awards, raffle, and the silent auction. Tickets are $250 each. Sponsorship opportunities are available. Register at 248-393-8255. 8974. See you on the links.
This message is brought to you by Office Express. OEXUSA.com. Ann Arbor Smiles welcomes Dr. Patrick DiDonato and Dr. Abigail Walker to their team. Patrick is a parishioner of St. Thomas the Apostle in Ann Arbor, and Abigail is a pediatric dentist with openings available without a wait. Learn more about them at AnnArborSmiles.com. The team at Ann Arbor Smiles offers nearly every specialty in two convenient locations, including cosmetic dentistry, braces and Invisalign, and even sleep apnea. Ann Arbor Smiles provides care for the entire family. Visit AnnArborSmiles.com.
Crest in the Afternoon is underwritten in part by the nonprofit Newman Connection. Did you know that 80% of students stop practicing their faith in college? Newman Connection has a program that reaches out to parishes to connect students to campus ministry even before they arrive on campus. This program has connected almost 150,000 students to campus ministry in 2 years and is endorsed in over 80 dioceses. Find out more at NewmanConnection.com. That's NewmanConnection.com. Let's all do our part in keeping students connected to church during college.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo.
Do you want an affordable health care option that enables you to protect your family and live your Catholic faith? CMF Curo is the Catholic health care ministry that works to bring health to the whole person, spirit, mind, and body. CMF Curo allows you to share health costs with other Christians and is more affordable than health insurance. Go to MyCatholicHealthCare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthCare.com. CMF Curo, healthcare fully alive.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta, and I'll be broadcasting from Acton University in Grand Rapids, Michigan from June 18th to 21st. Now, Acton University is a unique four-day exploration of the intellectual foundations of a free society. It's designed to help us engage culture and better understand our Judeo-Christian view of liberty, morality, and market-based economics. Learn more at university.acton.org. That's university.acton.org.
Are you tired of investing in the culture of death? Would you like your investments to be in line with the Catholic Church? Would you like an advisor who is a fiduciary and who understands retirement issues while sharing and respecting your Catholic beliefs? Contact Joseph Vitale at American Retirement Advisors at 855-756-5700. Helping you preserve your retirement while preserving your beliefs and values. Call Joe at 855-756-5700.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
What are the doctrines Catholics believe and why do we believe them? Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Join me on Power from the Pews for more than a minute with the Catechism as I quiz the experts, top theologians, philosophers, and catechists to share the truths about our Catholic faith. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. J.R.R. Tolkien is well-loved as one of the great writers of imaginative fiction in modern Western culture, and there is now a new biopic looking at his life and... Unfortunately, the early reviews coming out say that the film fails to explore a key part of his life, which, of course, is his Catholic faith. Well, joining me right now to talk about this and related matters is Joseph Pierce. Joseph is senior contributor at the Imaginative Conservative. He's a native of England. He's director of book publishing at the Augustine Institute, editor of the St. Austin Review, editor of Faith and Culture, and series editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions, the author of many, many books, including The Quest for Shakespeare, Tolkien, Man and Myth, The Unmasking of Oscar Wilde, C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, and many, many others. Joseph, good to see you back here again.
Hey, it's wonderful to be back, Al.
Let's jump to the Tolkien movie. You haven't seen it yet, but the reviews are coming in, and it looks... I just read one by Stephen Gradanis, and there was another one I was able to go through earlier today. It looks as though they're not interested in integrating Tolkien's faith into Tolkien's life. What have you heard?
Well, you know, I ironically enough, although this film has apparently neglected the centrality of Tolkien's Catholicism, I'm actually a little bit relieved because, you know, about a month or so back, I did a little bit of research into, you know, the film, and both of the screenplay writers for it were pretty hardcore LGBT activists.
Okay.
And the previous films were very in your face with that agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this vision of the what we might call the queering of Tolkien,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I wrote about it. I wrote an article called Wormtongue's Revenge, where I really thought, so actually, from what I'm beginning to hear about those who have seen the film, even though it's banal and it's ripped the Catholic heart out of Tolkien, I'm actually relieved that they didn't do worse, because I actually expected, you know, serious abuse of Tolkien, quite mm-hmm. frankly. You
so
know?
Banality is not desecration.
Banality is better than blasphemy, that's for sure, right?
The Tolkien, it's just hard for me to understand how this happens with people. Not only if you love someone, you want to present them in a way that they would recognize themselves. And is it possible to present Tolkien? Is it possible to present a de-Catholicized Tolkien?
No, because Tolkien's Catholic faith was at the very center of who he was, who he understood that he was as a human person, who he understood everybody else were as human persons, and how he understood the cosmos. And if you look at Middle-earth, it's quite clear that the opening chapters of the creation story of Middle-earth echoes and reflects the book of Genesis.
This is in the Silmarillion?
The Silmarillion. Yep. So basically, it's a monotheistic cosmos brought into being by a creative, poetic god with angelic beings. There's a war in heaven with quite clearly the Lucifer character falling into hell. There's a Saint Michael character who defeats him. I mean, it's all there. So for the very creation, and of course, the Lord of the Rings itself, Tolkien said, and I'm quoting him here word for word, the Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. I mean, how much more emphatic do you want to be than that, right?
There's nothing indirect about that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tolkien writes about the adventure, of Bilbo Baggins, and then, of course, Frodo. What's the adventure? Is the adventure the path of discipleship? How do you see
it? Well, at the core is Tolkien's understanding of who we are as homo viator. In other words, that mm-hmm. we are man on a journey. Everybody's life is a life journey and mm-hmm. a life story. The purpose of it is to get home, which from a Christian perspective is, of course, heaven. And the purpose of the story is to end, as all good stories should, with a happily ever after, which is, again, heaven. So the whole idea of Tolkien setting his tales as a journey. The journey is also a journey of rite of passage from a position of ignorance and sin to a position of true enlightenment, which is conversion. So in The Lord of the Rings and in The Hobbit, these are stories ultimately of growth in virtue mm-hmm. and a conversion.
Yeah. Friendship and community is vital in Tolkien's understanding of things.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are surprised by that because they think of him as some sort of eccentric philologist alone in his attic, you know,
right.
working with old tomes and, you know, only coming out to hang around with people when he has to, preferring dusty books to bright sunshine and trees.
Yeah, well, that certainly isn't the case, of course. Anything you know about him, he was never happier than drinking a pint of ale or two with C.S. Lewis and their friends at the Eagle and Child pub in Oxford.
Where I was last year, by the way.
Ah, well, I've been there several times.
I'm sure you have.
It's a place of pilgrimage.
Yes.
And also, they used to have meet once a week in the Bird and Baby in the pub, and they also meet once a week in C.S. Lewis's rooms in Magdalen College, and they would drink either beer or wine or port, and they would talk about everything under the sun in with great joie de vivre, great joviality and rambunctiousness. No, he was Chestertonian rather than reclusive.
people sometimes say that they catch the Christianity in Chronicles of Narnia and in Lewis more obviously than they get it in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
Yes, I think that Lewis was always a teacher and a preacher. And even in his stories, the didacticism, you know, making the point pretty inescapable.
I mean, Aslan, the line of Judah. I mean,
exactly. And Aslan's always and quite clearly a figure of the Son of God in all the stories at all times. Whereas Tolkien's much more subtle. So there are characters that remind us of Christ without ever being Christ figures. So the kingship of Aragorn is the kingship of Christ, and Frodo being the ring bearer is the cross bearer and therefore a Christ figure. Gandalf's death, resurrection and transfiguration obviously remind us of Christ. Lembast, the elven way bread, meaning in Elvish life bread or bread of life. So it's all there. It is, as Tolkien insists, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, but it's much more subtle than the Chronicles of Narnia.
Mm-hmm. For people who are unfamiliar with it, talk to us a little bit about the relationship between Lewis and Tolkien. We know they were very close friends for a while, but I'm interested in the kind of the shape of their friendship over the years.
Yeah, well, basically, Lewis began with feelings of suspicion towards Tolkien, because Lewis says in Surprised by Joy that he was taught explicitly from a child never to trust a papist. and implicitly upon coming to Oxford, never to trust a philologist. And he said Tolkien was both. Yeah. So, you know, at first there was actually feeling of prejudice and enmity, but this was overcome by their shared love of myth, their shared love of story, and so eventually Lewis forms a group called the Inklings, and Tolkien and Lewis are at the core of that group of friends that just discuss literature and story and life. Mm-hmm. So they became great friends. It was actually Tolkien, in Lewis called a long night talk on September 19th, 1931, that led to Lewis's conversion to Christianity. So we do need to remember that if it wasn't for Lewis's friendship with Tolkien, Lewis may never have become a Christian.
Yeah.
And if Lewis had never become a Christian, we would not have the Chronicles of Narnia or these other wonderful books that he went on to write.
Right, right. Did their friendship remain, it didn't remain the same, right? I mean, it went through growth and development, because both men went through growth and development.
Right. I think after World War II, there was a cooling, and the various views as to what could have caused this. Certainly one was the fact that Tolkien was not very sympathetic towards the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, when the first of the Narnia books to be written, and somewhat dismissive of it. And, you know, although these were people that openly criticized each other's works, I think there may well be, because Tolkien says in one of his letters he feels sorry that the whole Narnia thing was something that was beyond his sphere of sympathy. And I think, you know, if Lewis obviously is now, he's going to write seven of these, right?
Right.
So for him, this is something which is axiomatic and at the core of what he is creatively at this moment. For that to be completely outside Tolkien's sympathy has to do something to weaken the relationship. And the other thing was that, you know, when Tolkien discovers, he considers C.S. Lewis to be one of his closest friends nonetheless, even though they don't see each other quite as much. And he discovers that Lewis has got married after the event. You know, if your best friend gets married and you don't even know about it until someone else tells you, it's not. It's going to upset you a little bit, right? So
you have to recalibrate
the friendship.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Why was that, do you think? I mean, is this because Lewis had his brother that he was so close to? Did he have closer friends than Tolkien during the
Well,
years?
He was very close to his brother, but his brother was also very close to Tolkien. I mean, they in the Inklings, they were all friends with each other. I don't think that's the reason. No, I think that once Lewis met Joy, you know, Joy Davidman, it was rather unusual relationship. I mean, so he marries her civilly, but not sacramentally, which
right.
means he's saying that we're not really married.
Yeah.
You know, he married her so that she could basically come and live in England to get her out of the misery that she had found herself in the United States. But then, of course, they do actually fall in love. But she's a divorcee.
Yeah.
And in those days, the Anglican Church were not going very comfortable marrying divorcees. So he sort of sidetracked the bishop who was being obstructive and found a priest friend to give them a sacramental marriage, almost in defiance, if you like, of the Anglican hierarchy. And I think that Lewis knew that Tolkien would be less than favorably disposed to this sort of, should we say, reinventing doctrine for your own circumstances.
Yes.
And I think that's probably another factor in that estrangement, which is probably why Lewis didn't tell Tolkien about what was happening, because he sensed Tolkien would probably not be that sympathetic.
Yeah, Tolkien had a more absolute view.
Yeah,
he
was very traditional, and marriage is one flesh, and it's indissoluble, and the classic Catholic position. So Lewis was massaging things to suit his circumstances, and I don't think Tolkien would have necessarily have given the ground that Lewis might have wanted.
Tolkien and Lewis have both become extraordinarily more popular today than they were during their lifetimes. Lewis did not expect that his books would likely live on. There was some statement he made, I think, to Walter Hooper, that within 5 years he wouldn't be remembered or something of that sort.
Yeah.
What about Tolkien? Did he think that his work would live on?
Well, I've not read anything in his letters to suggest that he gave it much thought, quite frankly. But I do think that Tolkien realized in The Lord of the Rings he produced an epic. I mean, in other words, this wasn't just a transient work of
literature. When did he realize that? How? Because it is incredibly, it's magnificent.
Yeah, it is magnificent. And, I think one of the glorious things about it is that Tolkien wrote it not expecting it to be published. Because, it was meant to be a follow-up to The Hobbit, which was a conventional children's story, basically,
right?
And this thing grows out, it grows up, it grows in all sorts of directions. He thinks, well, nobody's ever published anything like this before. No one's going to want to publish this. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And as it got longer and longer, it became less and less publishable, right? Because there's no genre.
Who's going to risk it?
Right, who's going to risk it, precisely. So he wrote it largely through the encouragement of people such as C.S. Lewis. Tolkien called Lewis the great encourager, and if it wasn't for Lewis's encouragement, he would not have finished The Lord of the Rings. So we have to thank Lewis, actually, for The Lord of the Rings in that sense. But I do think that that he knew that he'd written something special, regardless of whether anybody read it. In other words, he'd written something genuinely timeless and genuinely valuable. And I think that the popular success of it took him by surprise. But I do think he wrote something he believed was of epic proportions, which indeed it is.
So you lived long enough to know that it was catching on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you bet. Yeah.
Okay. Joseph, thanks so much. Good being with you again.
My pleasure. God bless you.
Joseph Pierce, again, you can... by the way, how can people stay hold of your work?
Well, my own website, jpierce.com. CO is the easiest way to get me.
Okay.
And also, if they check out faithandculture.com, there's another place to find out what I'm doing.
Thanks.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a gift made from our day sponsor, David Williams, in memory of Anna Williams Sutherland. Eternal rest grant unto her, O Lord, and let your perpetual light shine upon her. Amen.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
We know we can't keep the good news to ourselves, but can we be more effective when we share it? Learn how to best lead souls to Jesus by joining St. Paul Street Evangelization for their Immersion 2019 Evangelization Training Intensive, June 6th through the 9th in Detroit, Michigan. They're offering engaging talks, breakouts, daily mass, prayer, fellowship, and hands-on training with 15 hours of street evangelization. For more information or to register, visit www.streetevangelization.com.
Hi, I'm Dan Weingartz. Join us for our Time to Mow sale going on now through May 18th. Our family has been helping families like yours choose the right power equipment for your lawn since 1945. Our experts will help you choose the right product from top brands like Steel. From legendary chainsaws, dependable trimmers, and powerful blowers, a Steel is designed for reliability and built for the long haul. Visit us to see the full Steel line or see all of our Time to Mow sales specials at Weingartz.com.
Weingartz, everything from lawn to snow.
afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being with me on this Friday and asking you to pray for us throughout the weekend. And we'll be back with you on Monday for another edition of Cresta in the Afternoon. Follow up, though, on what we begin discussing. So today we talked about Facebook and censorship. We talked about Catholicism becoming increasingly marginalized and Catholics themselves no longer being considered, along with evangelical Protestants, no longer being considered the conscience of a nation. We'll have more information on that at AveMariaRadio.net in the Cresta Guest Archives. Also, you can follow up on our conversation with Joseph Pierce about J.R.R. Tolkien. We'll have, of course, books in the online bookstore dealing with Tolkien's approach to the gospel, its role in the formation of Middle Earth. And also, we'll have some of the present reviews that just came out. Stephen Gradonis, for instance, has reviewed Tolkien, the film. And we'll have a few other reviews there, so you can get a taste of it before you go to the movies. I'm Al Cresta. Catholic Answers Live coming up next.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.